October 11th, 2025, day before Katina. I started reading this book that Ajahn Sudhanto gave as a gift to me, this The Golden Road, the way India has changed the, informed or influenced the history of the world, human history. And just kind of got through the introduction. It's quite fascinating because it was the way Buddhism has moved through the world since the time of the Buddha and King Asoka, the great missionary who spread the Dhamma to far and wide, different countries, and then the movements of Buddhism to the north and to Southeast Asia and so on, and Indonesia. And the author mentions Borobudur in Indonesia. It's this massive, massive Buddhist centers outside of India that formed up over history. Nalanda in India, this the kind of world's greatest university, and that there was 10,000 monastics living there, studying and practicing incredibly diligently and arduously, and this incredible library. And when it was in its heyday, that it was incredible study and people, monastics coming from abroad, from as far as China, and coming to see Nalanda, to study at Nalanda, the university. And that there was rules and standards around things like checking out books from the library. It was alive. There was standards. There was kawat there that was followed. And you could take a book if you wanted from the library. You could take it to your dwelling place, but it had to be, couldn't be stored in your dwelling place. It had to be stored in this kind of common area. But you could check out books, you could study, you could copy the books, you could write out notes and take them back with you, and so on. So this, just this sense of it being alive, that these things, Buddhist practice over history, has been alive in these various places that we consider just archaeological sites now. And that helped me to recollect that it's alive here now. So this is history. We're making history. We're making history with our goodness here and now. And I think that anybody who follows the precepts, whatever level of precepts, whether it's the 5 precepts taught by the Buddha, the 8 precepts taught by the Buddha, to the 10 precepts, the however many precepts that we follow, whatever level we choose to follow, we're making history with our goodness. And I think it's easy to overlook or underestimate the power of that, the putting just an energy of goodness into the world. It might be easy to underestimate the effect that has on the world as a whole. It does have a great effect, and it's the only way to have an effect, I think, in my opinion. It's the way we have an effect, because the world says, well, getting rid of everything that's bad, doing away with things that are bad, that's how to have an effect. But that whole energy of trying to get rid of something, trying to do away with things, that's the very energy. We're using the same energy. We're using the same energy to do away with what is bad in the world. We're using that energy, and it's, in a way, it's adding to it, because the energy of getting rid of, the energy of destroying, to try to destroy people who are destroying, it adds more of that energy into the world. But with kindness and generosity and precepts, ethical conduct, training oneself, body, speech, and mind to be wholesome, to be extremely wholesome, I do think that that is how to change things. That's how to have an effect, just to train ourselves, to train the mind. Because for any of the problems in the world, then we can't really blame any one person. We can't blame an entity or even a country, but we can blame the defilements. And where can we work at the defilements? We can work at them in our own minds. So we're making history. We're making history with our goodness. And people will look back in the future and say, there was goodness done here. Wholesome conduct happened here. It more often what we see if we say, watch the news, well, unwholesome conduct happened here. And that's what makes history in terms of the world. But what makes history in terms of the Dhamma is wholesome conduct, virtuous conduct, goodness, ending conflict, forgiving, not holding grudges, recognizing our mistakes, rectifying ourselves, rectifying our mistakes, and even things like repenting our past mistakes and cultivating as much kindness and goodness and generosity as possible, being very, very forgiving with one another, things like this, then we can't not get good results from that. That it's just only natural. Even if we were to say, I don't want good results from that, the good results would still come because that's just karma. That's just what happens when there's kindness and generosity and ethical conduct and training of body, speech, and mind. Then good results come from that. Well-being, gladness, and happiness comes from that. And when there's resentment or trying to get back at people, then suffering and dissatisfaction, discontent comes from that. It's only natural. Even if we think, may I be happy, may I be well, if we've planted the causes for suffering, then that's going to happen. So this law of karma is really the kernel of the Buddha's teachings, really at the heart of what the Buddha was teaching, that the law of karma is dependent origination. It is the Four Noble Truths. All of that points to karma, just cause and effect. If there's unskillful, unwholesome craving, tanha, then suffering will follow, just like a shadow follows you when you walk and the sun is out, or just like a trail of a wheel follows an ox cart, it will follow us. So the goodness follows us too. And then when we cultivate the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, and the teaching around that is when we cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path, then the wholesome will shine on us just like the sunrise. The sun, the light at dawn is the precursor to the sun rising. So good and wholesome conduct is the precursor to the arising of the Noble Eightfold Path. Just like when the dawn, the darkness disappears and the light begins to appear over the horizon, it shows that the sun is certainly going to come up. Then goodness, wholesome conduct, and the training of our body, speech, and mind, it dispels the darkness in a way that the Noble Eightfold Path has a clear cause to arise. So when we stick with the practice for a long time, I mean, having Ajahn Siddhanta here brings back all sorts of memories. I was trying to remember our first time when we met, and it was when I was in Anagarika. Actually, Ajahn Siddhanta wasn't here when I first came to Obayagiri. I showed up to stay in, I showed up as a guest for a 1 week stay in May of 2001. And there was a work monk. The work monk here at the time was named Tan Piasilo. And he actually disrobed a couple years after that. But I remember talking and chatting with him, and I seemed to have a good rapport with him. And also there was a few others here. We would have tea time in the little house that's not here anymore that was demolished in 2016. But I'd been in Anagarika for about probably, because I became an Anagarika in August of 2000. I came back in June to stay, and then I became an Anagarika in August of 2001. And probably November or December, was it before the winter retreat or maybe after the winter retreat? It might have been early 2002. Ajahn Siddhanta had been on Tudong in Thailand, and he came back, and I remember our first meeting. Do you remember that? He said, "You must be Leaf." Anagarika Leaf. So before I became Nyanako, that was my name, and I think he was eight vasas. He must have been eight vasas. We're about to enter his eighth vasa, so... Now I'm 23 and he's 31. 31 vasas. So just thinking back, there's so many memories, and so many memories of practice, so many lunar observance days where we sat in what's now the dining hall. It used to be the main Dhamma hall. So many memories of having Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro there up in the front and sitting up all night with them on the lunar observance days, and just so many experiences. And we were all trying to push ourselves in the practice, pushing ourselves with sleep or going against sleep, and a lot of good stories of falling asleep while meditating, different things that happen when you fall asleep meditating. For example, when somebody near you falls asleep while they're meditating and they start dreaming, and then they try to speak in their dream. And then that plays out in a very kind of funny way, usually. And somebody tries to say something in their dream when they've fallen asleep meditating, and then it's kind of like, and you're sitting there behind them and wondering what's going to happen. And I think it happened with me a couple times, trying to speak in a dream, and then kind of like waking up. And I remember falling asleep. It was actually during the winter retreat, and it was my winter retreat when I was in Anagarika, and I read in the suttas that you could go with 4 hours of sleep. So I was trying to do this for a period of time, and I totally couldn't do it. I totally couldn't sustain it. And I was just falling asleep in random times during the day. And we were doing this group meditation in the afternoon. And I remember I fell asleep, and then I had a dream that I was starting a chainsaw, and my arm kind of flew into the wall. Some of these, you build up these stories over time as you practice. And so we might think, well, I should get enough sleep so those kind of things don't happen. I won't be embarrassed and so on. But actually, those are the type of things we learn from when we can't really ever learn to push our envelope unless we see where it is. We don't know how to expand our limits if we don't see where our limits are. So then over time, getting to gain some experience in the practice and learning how to bring it into balance, and learning about food, how much to eat, how much is enough, or do I feel like I'm overeating? Well, how much do I actually need through the day? And learning how to gauge, sometimes we might feel like we've eaten too much, but that might be how much we need to get ourselves to the next meal. We might have a fast metabolism, for example, so we might need a little bit more food. Or for some people, they might need less food. Less food might be what gives them more energy. So everybody's going to be different in terms of food. And then there's the hindrances, the five hindrances of sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. So these five hindrances come up in various ways. And then the way they come up, it actually really affects that sense of how much do we need to eat? How much do we need to sleep? I really found the more aversion and ill will there was, the more drowsiness there was. And that didn't really change quickly. It changed very, very slowly. And it was only over time, say 10 vasas, 15 vasas, really looking back and say, oh, I'm not as drowsy anymore. I'm not getting as drowsy. Why? I have less ill will now. I have less anger, less aversion. So maybe there's a link there. So it's a very natural progression. As we have more goodwill, the mind has more energy. It's not necessarily through just plugging away at the meditation, although we do have to meditate every day, and we do want to be diligent with our meditation, but it's really about the lessening of the anger and the aversion, and then the mind naturally is brighter, the mind naturally has more energy. And then you see people sometimes who have, their minds are very, very wholesome. They have a lot of generosity, a lot of kindness. They don't need to sleep as much. It's only natural that they don't need to sleep as much. It's like the lady who owns the land that is going to be offered as the Humboldt Vihara. I kind of felt a little bit ashamed when she told me that she hadn't taken a nap during the day in 30 years. She hadn't rested during the day in 30 years. And that's something I've struggled with, is, you know, feeling like I need to rest in the middle of the day, at least a little bit. Not every day, but a lot of the time I'll feel like that. And oh, this person has a very, one, they have a good routine, and then two, their mind is very bright and wholesome, and they have a very generous attitude in life. And so, yeah, it's only natural that they don't have to rest during the day. And the years go by, I have many, many different Katina ceremonies and Vasa, the Vasa. We practice during the Vasa. Going to Thailand, the Vasa, the rains retreat period that we've just ended recently, and now we have a Katina period. But in Thailand, the Vasa is really, that's the retreat time. That's the practice time. That's the time to take on special practices. That's the time to really study the Vinaya and really look into how can we develop our practice more and more. For us, the winter retreat is more that time. However, we do still study the Vinaya during the Vasa period. It's really the one time we have formalized classes that take place in our monastic community. So we meet two or three times a week during the Vasa period and study the Vinaya. And this year we went through the Bhikkhu precepts, just 1 through 227. A lot of these precepts, they aren't really applicable to us now. There's certain things that certain precepts that have just never come up in modern times, but they still illustrate principles of conduct or ways of being that we can reflect on or we can train ourselves in. So there's one precept that's around, there's a precept, Paccitya 35, Bhikkhu's Paccitya 35, which is around not taking another meal after we've eaten at a donor's house already. Then the next rule is where a monk is holding a grudge against another monk, and he gets that other monk to break that rule. So he tricks the other monk into breaking that rule. So there's a rule against tricking a monk into breaking that rule. So that will almost never come up because that rule, it only refers to tricking a monk into breaking that other very specific rule. So it's like, well, I could trick another monk into breaking any other rule and it wouldn't be an offense. But the spirit of the rule is to trick a monk into doing anything wrong. Anything that's against the standards is incorrect. Although it's not technically a Vinaya offense, it's kama. It would be bad kama. So there's the letter of the rule, which is like, well, okay, I could trick a monk into eating something before this meal, Dana, and he would fall into that offense. But then if I tricked a monk into breaking another rule, I could say, well, it's not an offense, so it's okay. So that would be finding a loophole to get around the letter of the rule, but it would be not following the spirit of the rule. The spirit of the rule would say, oh, tricking anybody into doing something wrong is unwholesome, is unskillful. So when we look through all these rules, we look at what's the letter of the rule, how would you actually fall into an offense and break that rule, or what's the spirit of the rule? And so the Buddha is very clear in the suttas where he says, if there's a disagreement about the letter of the rules, if there's disagreement about just the on the surface of things, then that's a mere trifle. But if there's a disagreement about the spirit of the training, about the spirit of the rules, that's a heavy matter and needs to be discussed. Need to come to a resolution and find a way forward with that. So sometimes if we get too stuck on kind of just the wording of things or just the little nitpicky details of things, that's a mere trifle. But if we forget why we're doing the training, that's a big deal. That's something we need to look into. So really coming back to the heart of the training, what is the spirit of the training? What is the spirit of Dhamma Vinaya? What are we actually trying to do here? So it really comes back to sila, samadhi, panya. So precepts, sila, ethical conduct that becomes internalized over time for the sake of non-remorse. And then non-remorse is for the sake of well-being and happiness. Happy mind is easily concentrated. So when the mind has a sense of well-being and happiness, then it's much different than when the mind is in a state of suffering and dissatisfaction, discontent. When there's discontent, it's only natural that there'll be a lot of thinking and proliferating about how to get out of that discontent. But when the mind is happy and at ease, it's only natural that there'll be less thinking and pondering and proliferation because we don't want to get out of that sense of ease. We don't want to get out of that sense of happiness. We're already happy to be there. We're happy in the moment. We have a sense of contentment. And so the mind is naturally going to settle because it wants to be there. So of course, the happy mind is easily concentrated. It makes perfect sense. It's good to know that that's the precursor to samadhi. It doesn't come after. It's the precursor. It's not when I get my samadhi together, I'll be happy. It's when I get my happiness together, then I get samadhi. So then we look into what are the causes of that happiness, the gladdening of the mind. And we could see that's sila, but it's not just sila. It's also generosity, being very forgiving with oneself, with others, knowing how to have a mind like water in terms of just quickly shedding things, quickly letting go of things, quickly forgiving. There's the mind like stone, the mind like dirt, mind like water. Mind like stone is when something happens that's somebody criticizes us or something unpleasant happens to us. Then it creates an etch like in a stone and it lasts for a long time. We're not able to let go of it. And we keep reflecting on it and keep getting upset over it. And it doesn't go away anytime soon. Mind like dirt is like drawing a line in dirt. And the wind and the rain wash it away over time. It persists for a little while, but it gets washed away over time. I would think this is where most of us are at. The mind like dirt is when we get criticized or something unjust happens to us or somebody we like. And there's something unfair that happens and so on, then we can't let go of it. It persists and we feel upset and so on. But then over time, we're able to drop it and we're able to move on. So that's mind like dirt. And then mind like water is like drawing a line on water where the line disappears as it's being drawn. So we're dropping things as they're happening. We're forgiving as it's happening, like the story of Venerable Sariputta where the other monk punches him and then feels remorseful and asks forgiveness. That's the origin story of our forgiveness ceremony that we do. And Venerable Sariputta says, I was forgiving you as it was happening. I forgave you as the fist was digging into the face. I was forgiving you. So that's mind like water, being able to forgive as it's happening, being able to drop it as it's happening. And really, ultimately, it just goes through us. It doesn't even affect us. So it's sort of like somebody was reminding me of the teachings of Lungpa Buddhadasa recently, where actually it was one of the Anagarkas asking me a question about Thai because he's training himself and learning more Thai and listening to Ajahn Buddhadasa talks in Thai and asking about the word for selfishness, which is hengat dua. It means selfish, or it literally means to see just for yourself. Hengat dua. And so he says, tami dua. Gami kwam hengat dua. So if we have a sense of self, then we have selfishness. So for that mind like water, it necessitates that there's going to be that dropping of the sense of self. Because anytime there's that sense of self, something's going to stick to it. The criticism is going to stick to it. The unjust thing that happened is going to stick to it. And if that sense of self it grows lighter and lighter, or we hold it in a lighter and lighter way, ultimately what it is it's a reference point. It's very hard to see. And the mind like water is on the ultimate level, it would be the Dhamma of no reference, meaning it can't land anywhere. It's not going to land anywhere. But as long as there's a reference point, things are going to stick to it. Things are going to magnetize to it. So as long as there is a sense of self, there's going to be at least some selfishness that's only natural. And that's not even a judgment. It's just the way of nature. Even saying that people have defilements is not a judgment. It's just nature. It's just natural that there's defilements and there's the causes for the defilements and there's the results of the defilements. It's not saying we don't want anybody to berate themselves and say, I have so many defilements. And that's not going to make them grow any less. What's going to make them become less is to practice. So just to keep going in the practice, let the process unfold naturally. We keep going with the generosity, keep coming to these katinas, we keep practicing, keep forgiving, doing it over and over again. The Buddha said we have to do these things again and again, meditating again and again. When we meditate again and again, and we forgive again and again, and we practice goodwill again and again, and we let go of the defilements again and again, then one won't be born again and again. So coming, bringing things to not being afraid to set the bar high and thinking anybody can do it, anybody can go to the ultimate point. We just have to decide, what do we want to get from the practice? So the Buddha talks about Nibbana, or full liberation, as the most desirable thing we can achieve with a human life. We just have to ask ourselves, how many more times do we want to do this? Do we want to keep coming back again and again? Or have we had enough of suffering? Or like Meiji Gao, so anybody, I highly recommend the biography of Meiji Gao. If people here haven't read it, it's a great read. And that she talks about, when you start to practice, it seems like the end of suffering is really far away. But then over time, as you practice, and as you get yourself on the path, and as you put yourself in alignment with the Noble Eightfold Path, then at a certain point, the end of the long road of suffering will start to come into view. And there's a lot of encouragement and inspiration that happens at that point. For most of us, when we wake up in the morning, the mind is somewhat empty when we wake up, and that's a very precious time. That's something that's worth looking at. That's when the sense of self is going to be less. But then what we do is we fan the smoldering embers of our life every morning. So we get up and we remember, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be upset about, and oh, this is the grudge I'm supposed to be holding, and oh, this is what I'm supposed to, this is the person I'm supposed to be attached to, and so on. And we do that. That's our real morning puja. That's the real ceremony that we do every morning, where we rebuild those perceptions, positive and negative. So it's like we go to sleep at night, things cool off a bit. Our life is like, you could say it's like a little fire that's burning, and it's like smoldering embers in the morning. And then we get up and we fan the smoldering embers of our life, and then keep that suffering going. And so Meiji Gao recommends just to let them cool off. We don't need to fan those smoldering embers. Sometimes it's fun to try to retranslate Buddhist terms. And talking with one of the Anagarikas while they were driving me down for acupuncture one day, and thought of a different translation for samsara, which is normally translated as like the wandering on or the cyclic existence. But thought of a kind of a more fun, free translation of samsara, which is the charnel ground of forgotten dreams. The translation for samsara. So just that we have all these maybe dreams and aspirations, but are they ever fulfilled, and will they actually make us happy? So really calling into question a lot of these things is just what is it except a charnel ground of forgotten dreams? So when we make these, so when we follow sila and we're kind and very forgiving and very generous, and things start to get better for us, then we gain that inspiration and encouragement, and where it's like leaving that charnel ground and going to somewhere that's a bit more fragrant. It's going to somewhere that's more alive, much more alive, much more fresh, much more refreshing. And we will be, we'll always be refreshed and renewed and revitalized with the practice. And it can be painful at times to the things that come up in the practice, in terms of if we meditate, difficult memories and traumas and stuff may come up. It's kind of like the story of Lungpur Cha telling us that he's eating these spicy leaves they have in Thailand. It says like an allowable, and they're super spicy. And he's kind of talking about practice in terms of, it's like eating these spicy leaves. You're eating them and you're crying and your nose is running, and but they taste so good, you just can't stop eating them. But they're making you cry, and it's got a painful aspect to it, but they're also really good. And he said, when I've, through the course of my practice, I suffered so much. I tried so many things and I got it wrong so many times. And I suffered immensely in my practice, but I loved it. I loved my practice. So there is a sense of delight that can come from training the mind, even if we're not to that final point, even if we're not at the end of the long road of suffering that we've been undergoing. If we know we're heading in the right direction, there is a sense of delight that can come from that. So, and also, if we are holding precepts and practicing kindness and generosity, goodwill, and so on, we can be pretty sure we're heading in the right direction. So I'd like to wish everyone well on Katina Eve this evening. And I'll leave it there as a reflection for this evening.